We're talking civil liberties on today's program. The world is watching how American police departments are handling the protests. The UN sees a pattern of violations of international laws.
From rubber bullets to batons to tear gas.
Journalists have also been caught up in the protests, repeatedly assaulted by the police.
So this is sending a terrible message to the rest of the world. If journalists are treated badly here, what hope is there that they're going to be treated well in authoritarian countries?
And some good news for Swedish parents and kids. Summer camp during a pandemic can go on, just with a lot of rules.
We will maintain rules on social distancing when you eat, also when you sleep.
Parents ask, will it be safe? Kids ask, will it be fun? I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us this Friday. Civil liberties and protest, a theme we'll be following through the hour today as we continue to look at events in the U.S. this week. We begin with a perspective from outside the U.S. As a U.N. Special Rapporteur, Agnes Callamá has been a leading proponent for civil liberties and human rights. She led the definitive investigation into the killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Callamá joins us now from outside Avignon, France. Madame Callamá, civil rights groups are now suing the Trump administration for violating the constitutional rights of demonstrators. You've been watching events on the streets of the U.S. this week from France. Are you seeing violations of international law?
Oh, yes, I have, at least on the basis of the videos that I have watched and the reporting that I have read. There appears to be repeated violations of international law, in particular of two principles that should guide the use of force by police in terms of handling protest: necessity and proportionality. I have seen misuse of so-called less lethal weapon, from rubber bullet to batons to tear gas. I have seen the use of less lethal techniques, which have become very harmful, if not lethal, in at least the case of Mr. Floyd. So yes, unfortunately, at the moment, based on what we can watch on our screen and what we can read on our newspaper, there is a pattern of violations committed by police force in handling the protest.
So what or who are the authorities internationally, and what are they thinking about how to respond to what's happening in the U.S.?
First of all, in the U.S. and globally, I will say, there is an increasing awareness within the international community, the human rights community, and also the police community, that the so-called less lethal weapons are no panacea. There is a reasonable factor as to why we need them, because they give police a range of options in terms of handling difficult situations. And that is something that is welcomed. We certainly do not want the police to have only recourse to a firearm when confronted with a difficult situation. So the range of options that those less lethal weapons constitute is welcome. But in order to meet their purposes, which is to police in an effective and safe fashion, they have to be used properly. And what we are seeing is the repeated misuse, the absence of proper guidelines and regulations, legal frameworks which are enshrining excessive use of force and impunity. That is particularly the case in the U.S. because of the qualified immunity doctrine, which is applied to police officers. This is why I and others have called for an end of that doctrine. That will be a first essential step towards addressing the systemic impunity that is attached to excessive use of force. The second is proper regulations regarding those less lethal weapons. And the third is proper training attached to those less lethal weapons.
Agnes Callamá, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Agnes Callamá is a UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial, summary, or arbitrary executions. So that's how the conditions in the U.S. right now appear to an expert observer from abroad. Inside the U.S., aggressive police crackdowns are raising concerns among the ranks of our own intelligence community. Gail Helt is a former CIA analyst. Her focus was Southeast Asia and China. When we spoke this week, she told me she sees parallels between what's happening now in the U.S. and the aggressive regimes that she tracked.
Well, I mean, I have to say it. I think I would be remiss if I didn't, this being the 31st anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. And seeing those armored vehicles rolling down the streets of D.C. does kind of conjure those images in my mind of tanks running over peaceful protesters. And I know that that might seem like an extreme comparison to some people, but in my opinion, that's how unusual it is to see armored vehicles being used as crowd control on the streets of American cities.
Are there differences that you would underscore?
I definitely don't see, or at least I'm hopeful that we won't see, any kind of repression along those lines here. But America is a democracy. America is a republic. We are not supposed to use our military to corral peaceful protesters. And yes, there are some pockets of violence, and that's horrible. We can handle this. I think that there's been a ratcheting up of tensions that concerns me a lot. But we in America have a tradition of peaceful protest. It is a constitutional right. And I think using the military to crack down on that sends a horrible, horrible message about where we're headed as a country.
Earlier this week, Trump called on governors to, quote, dominate the streets or else he would deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them. That was the quote. The way to do this is through the Insurrection Act, which allows the use of active duty military forces to deal with unrest. But Defense Secretary Mark Esper has said he's opposed to invoking the act.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now.
Gail Helt, what does it mean for any leader to turn the military against citizens? I mean, do you have an example of that?
I would look at maybe Malaysia in 2012, 2013, when there were pro-democracy, pro-electoral reform protests, and the government, which had no interest in electoral reform, pulled out the rubber bullets and the water cannon and the tear gas. It's a breach of trust. If that happens here in any large-scale way, I think that the breach of trust is going to be something that's irreparable. And we already have a huge distrust issue with American citizens. We don't trust each other. We don't trust people of various other political parties. And this has been happening for decades. I mean, you can't pin that all on Trump. The fabric of our society has been fraying a little bit for a couple of decades now. But Trump has just basically pulled those threads and totally unraveled it.
Given what you've witnessed in other countries, Gail, that you've paid close attention to over the years, how worried are you personally for the U.S.?
I'm very worried. I've used the word terrified. I don't believe that if Trump is reelected that we can withstand four more years. The Constitution, nobody's defending it. I mean, I'm defending it. There's many of us, there's dozens of us who are former national security professionals who are out there defending it and trying to remind our elected officials of the oath that they took, just like the ones that I took, to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And they're not actually doing that. And to me, in my mind, until they do that, anything can happen.
Gail Helt is a former CIA analyst responsible for tracking developments in China and Southeast Asia. She's also a professor of security and intelligence studies at King University in Bristol, Tennessee. Thank you very much, Gail, for your time.
Thank you so much.
The concerns about authoritarianism and civil liberties also extend to the free press. Later this hour, the threats foreign correspondents have faced covering the protests in the U.S. Parts of Europe and the U.S. are beginning to resume a new version of normal life, even as several states here are seeing their numbers spike. In South America also, the numbers are not good. The rates of reported infections continue to climb every day. Dr. Carissa Etienne of the Pan American Health Organization is warning governments, be careful.
My advice is do not open too fast or you risk a resurgence of COVID-19. That could erase the advantage gained over the past few months.
As the world's Jorge Valencia reports, the crisis from Argentina to Peru is impacting people's livelihoods as well as their health.
The streets of Peru's capital went silent in March. But by this week, week 11 of economic shutdown, downtown Lima has stirred back to life. A local television reporter is standing on a busy street corner interviewing a woman named Miri.
Que trabajar, aunque sea que nos den de las 3 de la mañana hasta las 6 de la mañana para poder trabajar en un parque.
Miri says she just wants to work. She wants to sell things on the street, even if it's from 3 to 6 in the morning if she has to. She's wearing a mask with whiskers painted on it and carrying a black duffel bag packed with jackets she's selling. Right now, it's winter in Lima. Miri says she used to work at a preschool, but she's been out of a job since the pandemic hit. And with three children at home, she's starting to become desperate. And she's not the only one on the street corner. There are dozens of people selling jackets, hats, all sorts of knickknacks. And there must be thousands and thousands of people like Miri, says the host from the studio of Panamericana Television. Informal workers, people who live on day wages, are risking their health going out into the streets all over South America after weeks of being locked in without an income. Carissa Etienne is the director of the Pan American Health Organization. She says the pandemic is not just one single emergency. It's three.
We need to address those three emergencies at the same time. Health emergency, the social emergency, and the economic emergency.
Peru is number 10 on the list of countries with the highest number of coronavirus cases. The government has given money to small businesses and directly to Peruvians. It's also trying to enforce physical distancing restrictions. But Dr. Edward Malaga, a professor at Universidad Cayetano Heredia in Lima, says it's almost expected that people are going to go out.
You have many low-income households, which you'll be surprised. They have TVs, but they don't have refrigerators. So that forced them to go out every day to the markets to get their food. And that means, of course, overcrowding of markets and pharmacies.
Malaga says the Peruvian government uniformly applied distancing measures in cities and that initially it worked, but he now proposes targeting certain areas.
If you apply different rules to these different places, including the hot zones, you might be able to contain it in a more smart way. I think that's the only choice we have, because if we just open up everything or lock down everything, we'll get the same bad results as we've been getting.
Across the continent, people in Brazil are facing very similar circumstances. Naércio Menezes Filho, an economist at the Insper Business School in São Paulo, has been studying the economy of the pandemic. He says Brazil has millions of people working in the informal sector.
And they are overrepresented by blacks and women. And due to this social distancing measure, these families, we're talking about millions of families becoming poor.
Menezes Filho says the areas most affected economically have been where the most wealth is concentrated, São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. He says the Brazilian government has given a check for the equivalent of $150 to about a third of Brazilians. But he says reopening economic activity, as Rio de Janeiro is doing this week, is not a good idea.
We still have an increasing number of cases in São Paulo and Rio in particular. So even if you open up now, you probably have to lock down everyone again in a month or two. And then you have to deal with this uncertainty.
Filho says that one in four people in Brazil could end up unemployed. And this being South America's biggest economy, as long as it continues to struggle, so will the countries around it. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
A major medical journal today retracted a scientific article about the effects of a controversial coronavirus treatment. We've got that story for you later this hour. You're with The World.
The World supporters include Subtitle, a podcast about how we speak.
All of human languages are products of human brains and bodies.
We talk with comedians, politicians, anyone who thinks about language. Alien languages, too.
If I were a sphere with 9 eyes or 9 sensory organs placed around my diameter, how would that affect things?
Subtitle. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We've all seen the clips. Journalists caught up in the chaos of the protests this week. Assaulted by police, shot with rubber bullets, arrested. That includes foreign reporters like this Australian news team in Lafayette Square in Washington on Monday night.
My cameraman has been hit. We've also seen tear gas being used. Here we go, they're moving through again. This is exactly what it looks like. Exactly what it looks like. We're just staying safely.
Oh.
Whoa.
Amelia, can you hear us?
Amelia, are you okay? Or your cameraman? Hello, Amelia.
The government of Australia has lodged a formal protest. The Committee to Protect Journalists, the CPJ, has documented more than 300 press freedom violations in this unrest, including 192 assaults, more than 80% by police.
That's enormous and unprecedented in our lifetime.
Robert Mani is Deputy Executive Director of the CPJ.
We have not seen this kind of assault on this scale against the press for more than half a century in the U.S.
In the U.S., and are there situations around the world in other countries that remind you of this?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the democracy protests in Hong Kong, where you've seen the police go after journalists, tear gas them, beat them, but not on this scale. I think you'd have to go back in my memory to the way the Egyptian security forces behaved in Tahrir Square at the start of the Arab Spring in 2011 to see such a scale of attacks on reporters.
Robert, has there been any pattern of journalists of color being treated any differently in the last week here in the States or so than apparently white journalists?
The data is not in yet enough for us to be able to analyze that. But let's remember that one of the first things we saw against the press was the arrest of a CNN reporter when he was live on air. And he was a person of color. And one wonders why he was targeted and not others. But it seems that anyone who the police think is recording them or reporting is fair game. You just saw what happened to that Australian crew. And we've seen numerous other instances where journalists, including foreign news crews, have been targeted by the police. What's really disturbing here is that the police are attacking journalists after journalists have identified themselves as media. We've seen videos of people holding up press passes, shouting media, and being fired at with tear gas or pepper spray. We saw one journalist who was pinned to the ground by an officer and was holding his press badge in the officer's face, and then he was pepper sprayed in the face. I mean, there's no excuse for that kind of behavior.
I mean, generally, if you have press credentials, the belief is that you're protected. We see that whether it's a laminate badge or a car with press media on it. Have you seen that anywhere else in the world?
Yeah, we've seen it, but in the kinds of countries that the U.S. thinks that it is not. I mean, you can imagine the signal that, and the message that this is sending overseas. We deal at the Committee to Protect Journalists with journalists who are working in terribly restrictive environments in authoritarian countries. And one of the things that we do is we hold up as a standard of behavior, look at the way that in a First Amendment country, the press is able to operate. Now it's going to be more difficult to do that. And already we've seen the Russian foreign minister, for example, seizing on an assault on a Russian journalist as a way of condemning the U.S. And the Chinese, Iranian, and other authorities have done the same. So this is sending a terrible message to the rest of the world. If journalists are treated badly here, what hope is there that they're going to be treated well in authoritarian countries?
Robert Mani, Deputy Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The Swedish government has a controversial approach to controlling the coronavirus, and Sweden says sleepaway camps can go on this year. Still, some Swedes think it's not worth the risk. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
Aron Verstandig has a deep history with Glamsta, a summer camp in Stockholm.
So I've been there many times as a kid and also as a counselor. It's actually the place where my parents met in 1968.
Glamsta is Sweden's only Jewish summer camp. Verstandig is the president of the Jewish community of Stockholm, which runs the camp. He says that since 1909, Glamsta has been a safe haven for people to learn about Jewish traditions and practice a Jewish life.
If you are a Jew in Sweden, you belong to a very small minority. But when you come to Glamsta for 2 or 3 weeks, you're actually the majority. It's an amazing place.
A place that, in April, announced it was closing for the summer due to COVID-19 concerns. But under new guidelines from the Swedish government, Glamsta has reversed that decision. School is out, and summer camp is in session. Only 50 total campers and counselors are allowed this year, a fraction of the hundreds of kids who had signed up. And they all have to be local to Stockholm. Verstandig says the camp will see more cleaning than in years past. And
the most important is that we will maintain rules on social distancing when you eat, also when you sleep, and also that we will have as much outdoor as possible.
Glamsta will not be testing campers and counselors for COVID-19 before they enter campgrounds. which Verstandig says is in line with Sweden's unique approach to combating the virus.
Sweden has some of the fewest limits on social movement of any European country.
They're relying on individuals to follow health guidelines and abide by restrictions.
Bars, shops, cafes, and restaurants all open.
It doesn't appear that strategy worked. Sweden has the third highest mortality rate in the world, 44 coronavirus deaths per 1,000 people, according to Johns Hopkins. Testing for the disease has also run well below the level in other Nordic nations, like Norway and Denmark. Those two countries are now teaming up. At a press conference, Norwegian Prime Minister Erna Solberg said, quote, Norway and Denmark have agreed to reopen their borders for holiday and leisure travel between the two countries starting June 15th. That means residents will be able to move freely across the border without quarantining upon arrival. Sweden, which shares a 1,000-mile border with Norway, is not yet included in these plans. For some, closed borders mean closed summer camps, like Vineyard Nordic Summer Camp, a Christian camp.
I realized quite early that we probably have to close.
Jon Skoglund is a youth coordinator at Vineyard Nordic Summer Camp. 140 teens typically go there each summer, many coming from other countries.
Because of this closing down of borders and everything, quite early we understood that having people from different nations coming to a summer camp seemed quite impossible.
It seemed impossible, too, for the nonprofit Uppsala International Summer Session. Program director Nelike Dorstein says they can't meet the safety guidelines for summer camps that the Swedish government requires.
We do not want to compromise anyone's health. In the current situation, it would not be responsible of us to assemble such an international and large group of people.
Arne Verstandig from Camp Glamsta says he's not concerned about COVID-19 spreading inside the camp.
We've had a very good dialogue with the epidemiologists in Stockholm that have said that we're allowed to bring kids as long as they don't have any symptoms. And if they show any symptoms, they must leave.
They must leave and go home, which is where Verstandig says he does get worried.
I think the concern is that they will bring the virus back to their families or to their communities.
Verstandig says Glamsta will welcome its campers toward the end of summer, when, he says, the spread of the virus could have slowed and the environment could be more safe. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Whether it's a story about summer camp in Sweden or our coverage of racism around the globe, connect with us online. We're on Twitter, at The World. You're with The World. In Minneapolis, the restaurant of a Bangladeshi immigrant was burned down during rioting, but he's turning the other cheek and supporting the protesters.
I am not angry at all.
And a prestigious medical journal takes an unusual step, retracting a study about a controversial COVID-19 drug.
All of this is done is taken an open question and make it slightly more open.
That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. One of the world's most prestigious medical journals is doing the unimaginable. The Lancet is retracting a scientific article. It was about the effects of hydroxychloroquine in treating COVID-19, you know, the drug that President Trump has touted. The article found that the drug was harmful, but now three of its authors say they are not so sure. So what does all this mean? James Heathers is a research scientist at Northeastern University in Boston. Let's start with the science, James. What does this retraction mean? Is hydroxychloroquine harmful or not?
Well, I hate to be too scientific about the answer, but all of this has done is taken an open question and make it slightly more open. I wish I had something definitive to tell you.
So I know the study was hugely impactful. Can you describe some of the decisions made by policymakers and scientists after it came out?
Well, the media interest initially was tremendous, which is what always happens when a study that is the ostensive size that this one was is published in an outlet that is as prestigious as The Lancet is. There were a variety of trials that were paused, I think, in four, maybe five other countries, because this was a retrospective study of data that already existed. And given the size, several European governments, at a minimum, thought that it was irresponsible to continue to test the drug if there was this amount of evidence that was already available. So it gummed up the works quite badly for a variety of clinical trials that were already in progress.
So how did this paper on the benefits of hydroxychloroquine get published in the first place? Wasn't it peer-reviewed?
It certainly was peer-reviewed, but peer review can be questionable at times, not due to any failure of the reviewers or the authors, but because of the tasks that peer review tries to do. In general, it's quite a poor defense against serious anomalies that are not with either the narrative or the paper of the methodology, but within the data itself. In general, when something's peer-reviewed, the data isn't reanalyzed. The people who do the peer review don't see the data, they don't retest any of the calculations, and they don't see a lot of the context that's behind where the paper came to being from in the first place. So it's not a process that's really designed to protect against data that no one can explain where that data came from. Three out of the four authors said they no longer express confidence in the data, which sounds very polite, but in scientific terms essentially means I've completely lost faith in the source or the nature of this data to begin with. It's a horrible criticism to have to make of something that you've published yourself.
So how significant is it that in this particular case where we're looking at the effectiveness of a product, hydroxychloroquine, in the midst of a pandemic and it's retracted?
Everything that is a high-profile result about how to treat or mitigate or organize public health initiatives or cure the pandemic that we're dealing with is significant. At a minimum, this represents a substantial amount of lost time that would have been filled with making progress on what will be a much better answer than we currently have. And time is everything right now. Science is working very fast in general, much, much faster than normal, to try to get a better understanding of what frontline care should be. Robbing us of time right now is a terrible thing to do.
Are you concerned that there might not actually be any further clarity?
One of the things I've been concerned with since the beginning is that the initial evidence that was offered for hydroxychloroquine were pieces of evidence that if I was a peer reviewer, I never would have accepted for publication. They were uncontrolled observational studies. The data was incomplete, poorly reported in one case. It never would have seen the light of day if there wasn't this need.
James Heathers, a research scientist at Northeastern University in Boston, thanks for helping us understand this retraction by The Lancet on the effectiveness of hydroxychloroquine on COVID-19. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Anytime.
There are calls for racial justice here in the U.S. coming from across the globe, including from South Korea. For some Koreans, the demonstrations that have followed the police killing of George Floyd are bringing back some difficult memories. Jason Strother has our story from Seoul.
Americans protesting police brutality and racism have found an unexpected ally. K-pop superstars like BTS are joining the Black Lives Matter movement. They're sending out social media messages in Korean and English, calling for an end to racial discrimination. And they have a lot of backup. K-pop fans from around the globe have hijacked racist hashtags with videos of their favorite performers. There's a cultural connection here, says Bernie Cho, who heads the DFSB Collective, a music promotions agency in Seoul.
With a lot of Korean music artists, there's a deeper respect of the importance and impact that Black culture has had on their not only personal but professional life and careers.
It's not just K-pop artists and their diehard fans expressing support for demonstrators in U.S. cities. Ko Naun is a 17-year-old student at a boarding school in Connecticut. She returned home to Korea when the coronavirus hit. She plans to open an information booth in downtown Seoul and hand out info about the police killing of George Floyd and racial inequality in the U.S. She says she hopes it strikes a chord with other Koreans.
If they are more aware of what is happening in U.S., I feel like it would help them to reflect on what they have done in the past when they saw foreigners in Korea.
Ko says people with dark skin can often run into real prejudice from South Koreans.
They tend to associate African American or Black people as like more towards, oh, they're like, they're very strong and they have this strong image.
And Ko says the stereotypes get worse.
Black people are uneducated and they're like considered as inferior, or sometimes they would say like, oh, like, I know that you're being discriminated in US, but also you're the one who discriminate us the most.
To some Koreans, the protests taking place now in the U.S. bring back difficult memories. During the 1992 riots in Los Angeles, after the police beating of Rodney King, people here watched on television as Korean-owned businesses were looted and destroyed. Michael Hurt lectures on cultural theory at the Korea National University of the Arts. He describes himself as Black and Korean. Hurt says the news media here gave a very lopsided view of what was happening in L.A.
Back then, Korean media tended to be much more ethno-nationalist than it is now. And since the news tended to heavily lean on how does this affect Koreans who had businesses that were destroyed, I never saw a Korean reporter stopping a Black person around the area in question. You might want to interview some Black people, but that didn't happen in 92.
Hurt says 30 years later, Korean reporters are giving more context to the story in the U.S., and young Koreans, many who've traveled abroad and consume media from around the world, are more familiar with African-American culture and social justice issues.
I've seen Bernie Mac translate into Korean. I've seen Chris Tucker, Chris Rock, various facets of the Black experience. So they're seen more. And there's, you know, if you come out with a racist kind of blackface incident, which happens in Korea, you'll have Koreans coming out and being like, that's not cool. Don't you know what's going on? So there's definitely a broader exposure and a more sympathetic view these days.
But Hurt says there's still room for improvement. Earlier this year, two African Americans who play in South Korea's basketball league talked about the racial abuse they've had to deal with. That has included hate mail from racist fans. With everything happening in the U.S. right now, this is a time for self-reflection, says Lee Sarang. She works for an education consultancy that helps college students study in the U.S., and she says she's thinking hard about racism and xenophobia.
I'm trying to also make sense of like my role in all of this and just calling out the elders in my family who make racist remarks. I think Korea, because it's so homogeneous, right, that it's so easy to stick out if you're different. And I feel like we need to take a stand on this.
On Friday, a few dozen people held a protest near the American embassy. They wanted to denounce police violence in the U.S. and called on the South Korean government to protect the rights of minorities here. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
The COVID-19 pandemic is raising a lot of questions about the U.S. presidential election this fall. Voting by mail is one possible solution to keep people safe while allowing them to vote. But the mail-in ballot scheme has become contentious, and it raises questions about access to voting, including within the Latino communities. The World's Daisy Contreras reports on how Latinos are working to stop voter suppression.
In the fall of 2018, Alejandro Rangel Lopez was just a senior at Dodge City High School in Kansas. It was parent-teacher conference day.
And my friends and I were doing a voter registration drive.
And someone asked to check their voter registration status online. Rangel Lopez also looked up the person's polling place. He noticed something was off.
What popped up was not the Civic Center, which is where people normally vote here in town, but instead of that was the Expo Center, which is located outside of city limits.
And it wasn't a mistake. The county clerk had in fact moved Dodge City's only polling location, serving 13,000 voters outside of the city. The county clerk said the move was due to building repairs. A lot of people didn't buy it, though, and the midterm elections were only weeks away.
So that's where this whole thing started.
Dodge City is 60% Latino, and most work in the meatpacking plants there. The ACLU of Kansas sued the county clerk for changing polling locations. Rangel Lopez was a plaintiff in that case. He represented Latino voters in Dodge City who were afraid to lose their jobs if they spoke up.
This would further decrease Latino turnout and put Latinos in a place where even if they wanted to go out and vote, it would be so inconvenient and out of the way.
Then the Dodge City case went national. from Democracy Now!
Well, in Kansas, local officials are under fire for moving a majority Latino city's single polling site outside of the city limits.
To MSNBC.
Now, this was first reported a few days ago. Ever since this first got some national attention, people have been trying to rig up special bus service or ride shares.
What happened in Dodge City is just one example of voter suppression for Latinos and African Americans. Arturo Vargas is with Naleo Educational Fund, a group focused on Latino civic engagement. He says there are many ways governments keep people from voting, like requiring certain photo IDs in order to vote.
And then there are unintentional ones that result in discouraging voters. For example, cutting down on early voting periods so that there's a shorter voting period that people can use to vote before Election Day if they want to vote early.
These tactics have intensified. In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court removed some protections from the Federal Voting Rights Act. The original protections were in place to make sure African-American voters were not denied the right to vote. Now, local and state governments no longer need federal approval if they want to pass voting or election laws. So there are more lawsuits to be filed, says Vargas.
There have been some states where we have been successful in trying to get some of these voter suppression policies and practices withdrawn.
Groups like the ACLU are helping with the changes. Another group is LULAC, or the League of United Latin American Citizens, the oldest Hispanic organization in the U.S. LULAC was also a co-plaintiff in the Dodge City case in 2018, and most recently in a case last month in Texas, where communities of color are fighting to expand voting by mail. Domingo Garcia is LULAC's national president.
And to vote by mail right now in Texas, you have to be over 65, military, or disabled.
The main argument for the restrictions is that voting by mail should be only for those physically unable to get to the polls. Garcia says those restrictions limit a wider pool of possible voters. And now, with the coronavirus, there is even more reason to allow for a vote by mail.
I don't know if la abuelita, la tía, the grandma, grandpa, aunt and uncle, are they going to risk their lives to go wait an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours to vote?
Vargas with Naleo Educational Fund says Latino voters historically prefer to vote in person, but he also doesn't see another option.
The Latinos are much less likely to have had experiences voting by mail than non-Latinos. So unless voting by mail arrangements are accompanied by very robust public education campaigns to adequately educate Latino voters about how to vote by mail, this may actually erect more barriers to people being able to vote.
A judge in Texas is now allowing voting by mail for people concerned about the coronavirus. That's a win, says Garcia.
You know, I'm the eternal optimist. I keep thinking that mañana things are going to be better for Jose and Maria on Main Street and for Billy Bob and Mary Sue on Main Street.
Another win goes back to the Dodge City, Kansas case, the one that involved Alejandro Rangel Lopez. It took 2 years, but the city now has three polling places. Rangel Lopez, who's now 19, is glad to see that, but says voter suppression elsewhere is real.
I'm very worried about what's going to happen, and there needs to be a lot more attention paid to this issue than we're currently giving it.
This year, Rangel Lopez will vote for the first time. He reflects on his achievements as a high school senior 2 years ago.
You are never too young to start being politically active or to affect change in your community or your state or nationally.
For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
The protests against racism and police violence inspired demonstrations across France this week. 4 years ago, France had its own flashpoint with a black man dying in police custody in a suburb of Paris. Adama Traoré, a 24-year-old of Malian descent, was believed to have been killed by asphyxiation at the hands of police. Anger in France resurfaced this week with the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Franco Lolia is a founder and an activist with the Brigade for Anti-Negrophobia in Paris. I asked him what similarities he's seeing between what's happening in the U.S. and France. Lolia spoke with me through an interpreter.
So what we see that's pretty much the same that in the United States is the background problem is the same, but only the way it manifests sometimes may differ.
So blacks in France, as well as people from the Maghreb, North Africans, who live in the high-rise, low-income housing in the banlieue of Paris' suburbs, they have said they feel targeted by the gendarmes, the police there. Can you describe the banlieue and what the relationships are like between people of color there and the police?
The way the people are treated in banlieue, you have to imagine like it's like a map. We could compare that to the redlining in the United States.
Redlining, yeah.
So as long as you are behind those lines, you're going to be treated the way the psychological way of thinking about people of color, as you said, is supposed to be treated by the system.
Well, the historical context in the United States with systemic racism is pretty well known. We marked 400 years of the first enslaved Africans in the Americas last year. What are the roots of systemic racism in France, though?
Systemic racism in France that is rooted the same way it is in the United States because, as you know, American, before being American, were Europeans, and Europeans were into slavery, right? When we see people dying in France like Adama Traoré and many others, and you see it back in the U.S., Derek Chauvin, the cop with the knee on George Floyd, it's not like he is allowed to kill like that, like it's written on paper. He's already allowed to do it because the system behind him back him up with that.
More recently, the officers involved in the death of Adama Traoré were cleared. So I'm wondering, in the last week, the connections between Floyd and Traoré, have they become more acute, more intense?
What happened to George Floyd was on camera. And that's why George Floyd is not seen as the usual black suspect and guilty. So what happened to Adama was not on film. So the way they treat these cases, as they usually did, like guilty black men. So they didn't get, if I may say so, the chance to get their death on video. This is how cynical the situation gets for us to be able to prove our innocence. It has to be taped.
Franco Lolia is the founder of and an activist with the Brigade for Anti-Negrophobia in Paris. He's been speaking with us through his friend and interpreter, Fabian. Franco, thank you very much. And Fabian, thanks for your help as well.
Okay, merci à vous.
As I said a moment ago, last week, the officers involved in Traoré's death were exonerated by a police investigation. Joining me now is the world's Lucy Martirosian. So Lucy, you were on the phone with Traoré's family lawyer. What did you learn?
Right. So Yassine Boutrou, that's the family lawyer. He was telling me that
une dernière expertise indépendante.
There's this new independent report that supports Traoré's sister Assa and her family's original belief that he died by asphyxiation. Meanwhile, the original state autopsy that was done a few years ago said that he died because of underlying health issues, because of heart failure.
Donc, lorsqu'ils l'ont interpellé, ils ont fait une interpellation extrêmement.
And so here the lawyer is saying that when Adama, this 24-year-old French Malian guy, was arrested, he didn't have his identification card on him. So three gendarmes, that's another sector of the French police, they tackled him to the ground, three of them using their weight, so that's over 400 pounds on top of Traoré, and pinned him down. This is a popular policing technique in France called le plaquage ventral, or ventral plating. Boutrou says that Adama's last words were, "I can't breathe."
Lucy, is ventral plating actually legal in France? What was the defense for the gendarmes actually exonerated for?
It is legal in France. And Boutrou, the lawyer, he was telling me that there's one condition.
Ce plaquage ventral doit être
that officers can only use this technique to detain someone for a short amount of time. But that kind of force was used on Traoré for 8 minutes.
Yeah, grim similarity with the way George Floyd died.
Right. And Adama's sister, Assa, she's been tirelessly fighting for her brother's justice. She says that there are major links between George Floyd's death in the U.S. and that of Adama. And the Traoré's family lawyer agrees.
Oui, il y a beaucoup de points communs. Le premier point commun, c'est que les
first,
deux,
he says, in both cases, there were three police officers on Floyd and three gendarmes on Traoré. Second, both Floyd and Traoré said they couldn't breathe. Third, both George Floyd and Adama Traoré were black men.
Seriously tragic parallels. The world's Lucy Martirosian, thank you for this.
Thanks, Marco.
As we come to the end of this historic week, we're reflecting on some of the things we heard, including the support by immigrants in Minneapolis for African Americans there.
I am not angry at all.
That's Ruhel Islam, owner of the Indian restaurant Gandhi Mahal in Minneapolis. It was set on fire during the unrest there, but unlike many business owners who saw property damage, Islam unequivocally supports the protesters.
And we know if you don't speak loud sometime, protest, So you cannot make change. You cannot get justice.
Islam drew a direct line from what's happening in Minneapolis and across America to the fight that he and others waged decades ago against an autocratic government in Bangladesh.
So I know and I believe we have to protest to stop violence, stop killing people.
Buildings can be rebuilt and possessions can be replaced, Ruhel Islam says. The block his restaurant is on has been reduced to rubble. Yet Islam is still feeding protesters. He says this is a moment when change is possible if officials listen.
Protester, not blame on protester. Blame on people who did not take action for us.
Islam's daughter Hafsa is the age her father was when he fought against the autocracy in Bangladesh. She also says her restaurant is nothing compared to the life of George Floyd.
And yes, a lot of businesses will be struggling coming back up, but that's what community is for. Your community is here to help you build, you know, and our community is here to seek justice.
The family plans to reopen Gandhi Mahal, their restaurant. Hafsa says they'll represent what they've always represented, community. We leave you in a moment of calm on this Friday with a new track from Filipina singer Maine Mendoza. It's called Parang Kailanlang, which in Tagalog means just like when. It's about a dream and reminds us to keep those dreams alive. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. When we're not there, you can find us online at theworld.org 24/7. Stay strong, stay safe. We're back with you on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.